The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations, wrote George Washington, is to have as little political connection as possible. And certainly the aggravations involved in creating the new government described in the Constitution, putting firm checks on the waywardness of the states, restructuring the feeble public finances, drawing in foreign investment, and managing the talented but fractious personalities who composed the new republic's leadership, these alone would have taxed the patience and wisdom of Solomon, much less Washington. He did not welcome foreign distractions on top of it. Here, let us stop, was Washington's rule. But the troubles in the transatlantic world of the 1790s did not give Washington the peace and detachment in foreign affairs that he craved. International crises, like the one between Britain and Spain over the Nootka Sound in 1790, threatened to drag the United States into other people's conflicts, with demands that foreign armies be allowed free transit over American territory to attack their enemies. The French Revolution posed an even greater threat of disruption, and the uproar over Citizen Genet had underscored how difficult it would be to tell the tide of world affairs to stop? There were, for one thing, too many Americans, like Thomas Jefferson, who were convinced that the French Revolution was simply Act Two of the American Revolution and deserved American sympathy and cooperation. They would spend fruitless years discovering this hard truth, that democracies make revolutions, but revolutions do not make democracies. When, nevertheless, the new tricolor flag of the French Republic was formally presented to Congress on January 4, 1796, the Speaker of the House, Frederick Muhlenberg, had to warn the members and the citizens in the galleries of the propriety of not suffering the fervor of enthusiasm to infringe on the dignity of the representative councils of the United States. There were, to be sure, no shortages of Americans who saw little in common between the two revolutions, starting with Alexander Hamilton. Patrick Henry, whom Washington had approached as a successor to Jefferson as Secretary of State, feared that the French Revolution was destroying the great pillars of all government and of social life. Their systems of rights, like their systems of government, is metaphysic and fantastical, complained Jonathan Maxey, the president of Rhode Island College, a state which had its own dalliance with the fantastical. But what was of more immediate concern to Washington was the reaction of the British, who were now entangled in what would prove to be a two-decades-long war against the French Republic. The British had proven sulky and uncooperative in observing the terms of the Treaty of Paris. They remained an ominous imperial presence on the United States' northern border, where the colonial leadership was composed of exiled American Tories who longed for restoration, and where they could easily stir up troubles with the Indian tribes in the Northwest Territory. Also, the British placed trade barriers in the path of American shipping to the Sugar Islands of the British West Indies, which had once been Americans' most lucrative trading zone. To the Francophiles, who had made up the Democratic Republican societies, these were all reasons to put American bets on France. To Washington, these were all reasons not to antagonize the British still further with ill-conceived outbursts of enthusiasm for the French Republic. The British, of course, had their own view of this situation, which was that anyone who wanted to be a friend of the French was, ipso facto, the enemy of Great Britain. And to Washington's dismay, the British proceeded to inflame American fury, first by arming and supplying black slave rebellions in the French West Indian Islands. That stoked the fears of American slaveholders. Second, by routinely stopping American merchant ships on the high seas and involuntarily pressing American sailors into the service of the Royal Navy on the grounds that the sailors were really fugitive British subjects. And finally, on June 8, 1793, with an order in council which permitted the Royal Navy to seize any neutral ships and cargoes bound to or from France. And another order in council on November 6th confiscated shipping engaged in trade with the French West Indies. These insults provoked Washington in December to warn Congress that there is a rank due to the United States among nations which will be withheld, if not absolutely lost, by the reputation of weakness. And that meant making it clear that we are at all times ready for war. Madison thought he was taking a cue from Washington, and on January 3, 1794, he introduced a series of resolutions which amounted to a declaration of trade war on Great Britain. What we receive from other nations are but luxuries to us, Madison declared. If Britain was bold enough to interfere with American trade, then shut off the spigot. And in this way, make America's enemies feel the extent of her power. This would in turn have the desirable political result of freeing America from the influence that may be conveyed into the public councils by a nation directing the course of our trade by her capital, and aligning the United States with France, the only considerable power on the face of the earth sincerely friendly to the republican form of government established in this country. But Washington was only rattling his sword, not unsheathing it. The United States had sold the British $8.5 million worth of goods in 1790-92, twice what had been sold to France. The United States imported $15.28 million worth of goods from Britain, and only $2.06 million worth of goods from France. Moreover, yet a third order in council rescinded most of the British restrictions on neutral trade. And the Prime Minister, William Pitt the Younger, insisted that any seizures made under the previous orders were contrary to instructions given, and that the most ample compensation to the sufferers would be given. Seizing that moment, Washington appointed a special mission to London, headed by John Jay, and sent the mission off to negotiate a commercial agreement with Great Britain. None of the founders enjoys a more colorful portrait than the one of John Jay in the National Gallery of Art. Begun as a commission by Gilbert Stuart in 1793, Jay appears resplendent, almost monarchical in his black, salmon-trimmed robes as Chief Justice of the United States. When the Jay family exhibited the portrait years later to members of the Supreme Court, they were very much surprised that such robes had been worn by any Chief Justice of the United States. Born in New York City, John Jay was a Gothamite to the fingertips. A graduate of Columbia in 1764, Jay was licensed as a lawyer in the New York courts in 1768, and married into the all-powerful Livingston clan in 1774. He was, one observer wrote, possessed of a strong understanding by the study of law, but was touchy and aloof. You can sooner gain him to your opinion by submitting to be confuted by him than by a direct attempt to convince him. Sharp-faced, sharp-nosed, sharp-chinned, Jay was also sharp-tempered. He is obstinate, indefatigable, and dogmatical. Still, by his courage, zeal, and abilities as a writer and speaker, he has much popularity. He was the youngest member of New York's delegation in the First Continental Congress, and sat on the Committee for Foreign Correspondence, that sent the first American emissary, Silas Deane, to Europe in search of aid and allies. And in 1779, Jay turned diplomat himself as minister plenipotentiary to Spain. It was in this position that he was named to the team that negotiated the Treaty of Paris, along with Benjamin Franklin, the American representative to France, and John Adams, the representative to the Netherlands. Jay expected to return to the practice of the law once the Treaty of Paris was signed, but he had barely stepped off the boat in New York City in July 1784 when he was notified that the Confederation Congress had nominated him to fill the post of Secretary for Foreign Affairs. This was bound to be a thankless task, as Jay discovered when the first Spanish diplomat, Don Diego de Gardoqui, arrived in Philadelphia in 1785. Spain had belatedly joined the Revolutionary Alliance of France and the United States, less out of sympathy for America and more with an eye to recovering colonial properties in North America from the British. They were rewarded, in fact, with the repossession of Florida by the Treaty of Paris. But unsatisfied, the Spanish now claimed exclusive rights over the Mississippi River and closed the mouth of the Mississippi at New Orleans to American traffic. I am not sanguine in my expectations that a satisfactory termination of this negotiation is practicable, Jay warned the Confederation Congress. The United States had little in the way of leverage with the Spaniards. But without a settlement, there would always be a nagging temptation for the frontier settlements to wonder whether their future was more assured as citizens of the United States or as subjects of Spain. In the end, the best that Jay could do, after 3 years of negotiation, was an agreement by the Spanish to permit American use of the Mississippi River, but only with the payment of prohibitive tolls. The frustrations of always dealing the Confederation's poor hand convinced Jay that the construction of our federal government is fundamentally wrong. To vest legislative, judicial, and executive powers in one and the same body of men, and that too in a body daily changing its members, can never be wise. His post as Secretary for Foreign Affairs precluded a seat in the Constitutional Convention, but not in the New York Ratifying Convention. And it did not prevent him either from joining with Hamilton and Madison in writing the Federalist Papers. After ratification, Jay stayed on as interim Secretary for Foreign Affairs until the recall of Thomas Jefferson from Paris in 1789. As soon as Jay laid down that office, Washington appointed him to another as Chief Justice of the new Supreme Court. And in April 1790, Jay commenced his first circuit through New England. But in April of 1794, it was Foreign Affairs which reclaimed Jay's attention. And on May 12th, Jay left for England. Jay was formally presented to King George III on July 2nd, 1794. And for the next 4 months, Jay and the British Foreign Secretary, William Grenville, by the way, the son of the George Grenville who had devised the infamous Stamp Act, together, Jay and Grenville pieced together a comprehensive treaty which would address not only the commercial issues of 1794, but all the unfinished business still dangling over since the Treaty of Paris. Grenville assured Jay that His Majesty's wish was that the most complete and impartial justice should be done to all citizens of America who may, in fact, have been injured by any of the proceedings above mentioned. And this, as it turned out, was not just diplomatic fluff. The British did not need a second war with the Americans at that moment. And the trade balance between Britain and America was so lopsidedly favorable to Britain that British merchants would be ruined in the event of a war. A final draft of a treaty was ready as early as August 30th, and was signed on November 19th. At its core, the 28 Articles of Jay's Treaty involved four major deals. First, Britain would complete the evacuation of the military posts it had held onto since the end of the Revolution by June 1, 1796. While debts owed to British merchants since the Revolution would be appraised by a five-member commission, and the United States would make full and complete compensation. Second, disputed boundaries between the United States and British Canada would be resolved by three-member commissions. Third, there would be a reciprocal and entirely perfect liberty of navigation and commerce between their respective people. Neither nation would confiscate non-military property of the other, and although Britain reserved the right to confiscate French property found on American vessels, that part only which belongs to the enemy shall be made prize, and the vessel shall be at liberty to proceed with the remainder without any impediment. Fourth, Britain would grant most favored nation status to the United States in East Indian trade, plus access to the West Indian islands for trade strictly between the United States and the islands. Given the disparity in power between the United States and the British Empire, this was not a bad arrangement. In fact, one measure of how much it accomplished was the panic that ensued in the minds of Madison and Jefferson when news of the treaty was gradually leaked to the British, French, and American press. If anything of this kind should have taken place, I know the dilemma into which you will all be thrown, wrote Jefferson's acolyte, James Monroe, from his new position as American minister in Paris. The Western ports are offered you, compensation for losses, free trade to the islands, under the protection of the all-powerful British flag. Canada is, or will be, given up, whereby the fisheries become more accessible. England will no longer support Spain in favor of the Mississippi, etc. This will be resounded in the public papers, and the impudence of the British faction become intolerable. But the exact terms of the treaty were not entirely well known, and they did not arrive in Philadelphia until March 7, 1795, because the first two copies of the treaty had been sent in a ship which was attacked by a French privateer, and both copies had been pitched over the side to prevent capture. So there was nothing for quite a considerable time to feed upon but suspicion in American opinion. Suspicion, however, was more than sufficient to blow the embers of the Democratic-Republican societies into a flame, which roared that any treaty with the British could only be a sellout. Fisher Ames prophesied that the success of Mr. Jay will secure peace abroad, but kindle war at home. We will be told, Ames said, even before the event is known, that the treaty has surrendered everything. Oh, indeed, they were told exactly that. Madison was sure that the bargain is much less in our favor than might be expected. He was nervous that Jay has been betrayed by his anxiety to couple us with England and to avoid returning with his finger in his mouth. When the treaty's third copy finally arrived, 4 days after Congress adjourned, Washington sequestered the surviving copy until Jay himself could arrive, and then called for a closed special session of the Senate for June 8, 1795. The actual proceedings in the Senate were comparatively tame. Federalists held a safe majority there, and the Senate took only 2 weeks of debate before advising and consenting to Jay's treaty on June 24th. The real explosion came once the Senate adjourned, and unsympathetic anti-treaty senators released their copies of the treaty to the newspapers. Benjamin Franklin Bache's Aurora hit the streets of Philadelphia with an abstract of the treaty on June 29th, followed by a 25-cent pamphlet version of the full text. And from there, wrote Madison, it flew with an electric velocity to every part of the Union. Electric was putting it mildly. A 4th of July parade in Philadelphia turned into a protest riot. On July 18th, a mob in New York City burned a copy of the treaty on John Jay's front door. And when Alexander Hamilton offered to debate the treaty publicly, he was greeted with a volley of stones. Another public meeting in Philadelphia on July 25th featured Blair McClanahan announcing, "What a damned treaty. I make a motion that every good citizen kick this damned treaty to hell." William Manning, a farmer and amateur political philosopher from Billerica, Massachusetts, who lived near the scene of Jay's rebellion, described Jay's treaty as the worst instrument that was ever signed in America. It did not help, either, that Washington was delaying putting his signature to the treaty. He had been advised by Edmund Randolph, who had succeeded Jefferson as Secretary of State, that a new order in council had been issued by the British, which contradicted the opening of the West Indies to American ships as specified in the treaty's 12th article. Washington could not bring himself to sign the treaty until he had some satisfaction from the British that this new order in council would be revoked. What he did not know was that Randolph, and this is the same Randolph, the same Virginian, who had introduced the Virginia Plan of the Constitutional Convention and then refused to sign the finished document, Randolph had been passing information on the treaty to the new French minister in Philadelphia, Pierre Adé. But the French diplomatic correspondence was itself intercepted at sea by the British, and the incriminating revelation of Randolph's duplicity was quietly put into the hands of Washington's current Secretary of War, Timothy Pickering, who met with Washington privately on August 11th to unveil what the French called the precious confessions of Mr. Randolph. The next day, Washington assembled his cabinet to discuss the treaty with the unsuspecting Randolph, urging Washington to continue postponement of signing. Washington suddenly stood up and said simply, "I will ratify the treaty." On August 18th, Washington signed the treaty, and the following day he personally accused Randolph of treachery and demanded his resignation. The wind went out of the anti-treaty sails with Randolph's exposure, and the storm which the business of the treaty threatened to raise seemed to be blown over. A month after signing the Jay Treaty, Washington released an announcement through David Claypool's American Daily Advertiser that he would retire from the presidency at the expiration of his second term in March 1797. "The shade of retirement is as necessary to me as it will be welcome," he wrote. And he confided to Light Horse Harry Lee that no man was ever more tired of public life. He would be 65 years old at that point, and the years were telling on him. Invited to an assembly ball, Washington declined sadly. "Alas, our dancing days are no more." Nothing drew out his wrath more easily than the party spirit he had seen from Jefferson and Madison, and from the opposition to Jay's treaty. "The first wish of my heart was, if parties did exist, to reconcile them," Washington claimed in a rebuke to Thomas Jefferson on July 6, 1796. "And to this I may add, and very truly, that until the last year or two, I had no conception that parties would or even could go the lengths I have been witness to." Still, nothing set off party racers faster than Washington's retirement announcement. The elections of 1792 were the first intimation of a struggle between the Treasury Department and the Republican interest. The Democratic-Republican societies of 1794 were a much clearer sign that Americans would cheerfully abandon self-denying public-spiritedness in exchange for organizing in their own self-interest. The existence of two parties in Congress are apparent, warned Colonel John Taylor in a pamphlet that he published in the spring of 1794, a definition of parties or the political effect of the paper system considered. The uproar over the Jay Treaty only gave party polarization an unlooked-for boost. But the final thread was sewn in the spring of 1796, when the anti-treaty members of Congress, now calling themselves simply Republicans, held their own caucus to endorse candidates for the upcoming presidential election. The principal Republican candidate, it was clear, would be Thomas Jefferson. Since the Constitution mandated that presidential electors vote for two candidates, the caucus supplied a second name from its newer ranks, Aaron Burr of New Jersey. And as if to point up still more new ways for a party to organize, a new cadre of campaign promoters and managers volunteered for election service. In Pennsylvania, John Beckley, a disciple of Jefferson's, sowed 50,000 Republican ballots and handbills across Pennsylvania, urging the friends of the people who love liberty to go to the polls on November 4th and elect 15 good Republicans as presidential electors who will vote for a Republican president. Beckley also targeted Federalist congressmen for defeat, scheming to throw out Speaker of the House Frederick Muhlenberg, who gave the casting vote for the British treaty, and elect in his place Blair McClanahan, who recommended to kick the treaty to hell. Philadelphia's John Smith, a hatter by trade, undertook and performed an election campaign of 600 miles. "The object I had solely in view," he wrote, "was to make Mr. Jefferson president. For upwards of the 3 weeks I was out, there was not one day I was not on horseback before the sun rose, nor put up at night till after it set. In that time, I held 18 public meetings, making it a practice at night to pay some person immediately to go through the neighborhood and notify the people to attend that night, at which respective meetings I addressed myself to them in a zealous language." But what was sauce for the goose was sauce for the gander. The Federalist majority in Congress held their own caucus and produced their own nominees for the presidency, John Adams, the sitting vice president, and Thomas Pinckney of South Carolina. What was more, Adams enjoyed the blessing of Washington. "I am the heir apparent, you know," he wrote to Abigail after dinner with Washington in January 1796. But balanced against Washington's prestige was the tumult over the Jay Treaty. And one member of the Federalist caucus, William Bingham of Pennsylvania, warned Rufus King, who was now American minister to Great Britain, that the friends of Mr. Adams may calculate on a majority in his favor, but so small that on so momentous an occasion, it would be risking too much to trust entirely thereto. When the electoral votes were counted on February 8, 1797, it turned out to have been a near-run thing after all. Adams won 71 votes in the Electoral College, but Pinckney had tallied only 59. 68 had gone to Jefferson, thus making the two loggerhead opponents president and vice president, in what would turn out to be the most unequally yoked presidential administration in American history.